Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak.
And joining us for the first half of the show today is Kirk Wallace Johnson, the author of The Feather Thief. The book is about how 20-year-old American flautist Edwin Rist committed one of the most unusual crimes of the 21st century by stealing 299 bird skins from the Tring, a branch of the British Natural History Museum. So, Kirk, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So tell us how you happened upon this story. Before we dig into the tale here, tell us how you came upon this strange story.
Well, I was at a completely different place in my life. I was in the midst of an eight-year battle with the U.S. government on behalf of tens of thousands of Iraqi refugees who had been hunted because they're seen as traitors for helping the Americans during the war. I was over there. I was the U.S. government official in charge of trying to rebuild the city of Fallujah. And when I got back to the States, a number of my Iraqi colleagues were killed and others were driven from the country. And I kind of tumbled into this cause trying to get them to safety. And as the years stacked up and the pressures mounted, I found that the only real escape that I could get from all of it and the real peace of mind I could get came from fly fishing. And so whenever I had a free day, I would throw my gear into the trunk of the car, and at the time I was living in New England, and I would shoot up to Vermont or New Hampshire and just fish all day. And 8 years ago, I was in northern New Mexico, and I hired a guide to show me the ropes of this local river, and like halfway through the day, as he's opening up his fly box to tie a new trout fly on the line, I caught a glimpse of this stunning-looking thing that I'd never seen before, and it was one of these Victorian salmon flies. It was crimson and iridescent green and canary yellow, and I started peppering him with questions about it, because for any of your listeners that know the world of trout fishing, that trout flies are not pretty things by any measure.
Right.
They're made to be functional. This didn't seem like any insect I'd ever seen on the planet. And after I'm kind of peppering him with all these questions, at some point he said, well, if you think that's strange, you should hear about this kid that broke into the British Museum, stole $1 million worth of exotic birds so that he could pluck these feathers and sell them for hundreds of thousands of dollars in order to buy a golden flute. And as he was saying this impossibly strange story, I mean, as it was happening, my brain kind of lit up where I was like, this is the weirdest story I've ever heard. There must be more to it. And that's really where this all began.
And so, I mean, I think it does sound strange to so many people when you hear that somebody risked, you know, life and limb and jail time and reputation to break in to, you know, a British National Museum and steal feathers, you know? So tell us about kind of what it was that he particularly had his eye on and a little bit more about why.
Sure. Well, so the Victorian art of salmon fly tying kind of coincides with this huge story about our relationship to the planet and to the natural world. All of this really began in the peak of what was known as the feather fever, but where women were competing to wear exotic birds in their hat and in their piled hair. And they think all of this started when Marie Antoinette wedged a diamond-encrusted feather into her hair and kicked off this kind of global, almost like an arms race, where women were competing to wear the more rare birds on their hats. Historians have said that that's the single largest direct extermination of wildlife in the history of the planet, and it had a central role in birthing the modern conservation movement, was to protect birds from being fully exterminated for fashion. And at the same time that all that was happening, these British aristocrats who were, you know, had their private clubs on these rivers in Scotland and Wales and elsewhere, we're using those same birds and plucking the same feathers to tie these really beautiful and ornate patterns or recipes, they're called. And they have these names like the Jock Scott and Exordium and the Green Highlander. But crucially, I mean, salmon are essentially colorblind when they're spawning. They're certainly not feeding either. And so there's no biological basis for any of this. There's no reason why a salmon in Scotland would ever meet, much less be drawn to a feather from a bird of paradise from the highlands of New Guinea. This is purely a on the plane of artifice. But Edwin Rist, the feather thief at the center of this story, started tying these flies at a very young age, at 10 or 11 years old. And within a few years of his first fly, he was hailed as the future of fly tying by this community, by its publication. And he would go around the country competing in these tournaments and taking first prize for his flawless creations. But the problem was that he could never afford the quote-unquote real feathers, the ones that came from these exotic birds, because whenever they occasionally popped up on eBay or elsewhere, they were always bought by wealthier, older men who could afford this. And we're just, so you know, like, I mean, we're talking about a 5 or 6 feathers the size of your pinky fingernail go for maybe $100.
Wow. I think you said in the book.
I mean, there are some flies that require $2,000 worth of feathers to tie just one of them.
Right. Much more valuable than gold, right?
Per ounce. Yeah. I mean, but it's just it's a small kind of very intense demand within this community, because the guys that do this today, and it's almost exclusively men, have kind of like consecrated these recipes from the Victorian era almost with like a religious reverence. They feel like they have to tie them exactly the way they were tied back then. And so Edwin, when he was accepted to study at the Royal Academy of Music in London, got a call from one of his mentors saying, you've got to get to this British Museum. You've got to see these birds no matter what. And so he under false pretenses, wrote and said that he was a student photographer and he just wanted to see the birds. And they gave him access. This is the second largest ornithological collection on the face of the planet, 750,000 bird skins, which have been used for countless scientific study over the generations. And they let him in, and he took a lot of pictures of the birds, but he also took pictures of the windows and the entry and exit points, and he was basically casing the place from his first visit. And it took about 8 months of planning, so in between rehearsals and concerts and class, he ordered a diamond blade glass cutter and wire cutters, and he ordered thousands of little Ziploc bags that he would eventually use to sell these things off to this community.
I like the fact that he also opened up a file, created a file on his laptop titled something along the lines, Mission to Invade the Tring Museum, or something along
those
lines.
It was actually planned for museum invasion dot dot. So
invasion.
When the cops found that on his computer, it wasn't the best look. but he, you know, the thing is that these specimens, we understand evolution through natural selection because of this collection. We can definitively prove that mercury levels are rising in the oceans because we have these collections, that scientists can pluck a feather from a seabird that was gathered in 1820 and compare it to the same species gathered from the same island in 1850 and 1890 and 1930. And we can show that mercury levels are rising. I mean, we could spend hours just talking about how these things have been deployed to advance human knowledge, and knowledge that not just helps humans, but helps the planet. The people who collected this and who have protected these specimens for literally hundreds of years have understood that they hold answers to questions that scientists haven't even thought to ask yet.
Mm-hmm.
But to this community, because there's such a reverence for the beauty of these feathers, on the black market, what he stole was roughly worth about $1 million.
Wow.
And so when he
all shoved into
when
one suitcase,
showed up at the
right?
museum, he wheeled an empty suitcase up this alleyway behind the museum, scaled the wall, snipped away some barbed wire, broke the window out, and I think he had something like 3 or 4 hours in the museum. The guard was allegedly distracted by watching a soccer game. And he crawled back out the window. He came in and went back to his dorm room and started plucking the feathers, and he had a ravenous market to sell to. There were Americans hopping planes to fly to London to buy this stolen stuff.
Well, unknowing, but they obviously didn't know that this was stolen property.
Some of them, it kind of beggars belief that they wouldn't know. I mean, it requires a certain convenient ignorance not to ask the question, how does a 20-year-old college student suddenly how is he suddenly sitting on $1 million worth of birds?
Yeah.
I mean, some of the specimens that he stole have not appeared on the fly tying marketplace for decades. Edwin stole, I think it was all 17, might have been 17 or 19. He stole every one of the museum's flame bower birds. And if your listeners have ever seen this incredible bird, part of its mating dance is that it kind of drops one wing almost like a matador, and it dilates its pupils in an alternating way. It's very hypnotic.
Right.
And the 19 birds that he stole were constituted not only the entire collection from that museum, but there were something only like 30 of those birds in all of the museums in the planet. And so in one fell swoop, it's a huge hole in the scientific record. And so, what he told me, what the feather thief told me, was that most of his customers knew enough not to ask questions.
Right.
And that if they needed a convenient cover story, then he would give them one that he found it at an estate sale or something like that.
Right.
And, you know, as you kind of alluded to, like, some aspects of this crime are, like, comedic. I mean, this is like a 20-year-old kid throwing a rock through a window, lugging a rolling suitcase into a museum, and hanging out there for hours.
Missing the train. Missing the last train back to London. So he spent the night at a train station or walking around Tring.
With $1 million in his suitcase.
And then the museum didn't know what was missing for almost a year, correct? Or not a year, but
yeah,
quite a period of time.
Initially, when the following morning, they found the broken glass, and they raced to make sure that Darwin's birds were all still in place, and then they just kind of were driven by wishful thinking, but they concluded that it must have been someone who was just like doing a smash and grab, looking for laptops or iPads or things like that.
Mm.
There are, in the museum's defense, there are, with a collection this big, I mean, they have, I think, almost 3 miles of specimens just in spirit, in preserved jars. They have 1,500 cabinets with 20 or 30 drawers in each. I mean, it takes weeks for them to do an entire inventory check at a minimum. And so but in this case, they just thought someone broke the window out and then left.
Hmm.
It wasn't until 35 days later that someone pulled open one of the cabinets expecting to find, 50 birds, and they found nothing. And then they started pulling open drawer after drawer after drawer and realizing the huge extent of this loss. But crucially, because it was 35 days, the CCTV footage had expired 28 days after the heist. And so even if Edwin had left any kind of, leads by video, that those had already been sort of overwritten.
That That's what's kind of amazing to me, Kirk, that if there's a rock through your window, your security alarm goes off, that it would take you 35 days to look at the CCTV, to finally say, hey, maybe we should look at the CCTV video. Wouldn't that be something you would do day one? I know this down, you know, a separate path, but that just seemed to be, like Nell says, a collection of almost comedic errors that occur.
I know, and, you know, like, there are times where, even after all these years, I still can't believe this happened because it's just so crazy to me. But at the same time, I've also tried to, you know, I get frustrated with the British Museum because there are plenty of things that I think they should have done differently. They didn't actually play any role in what eventually led to the arrest of the feather thief. They, even though he had written to them with his own name and asked to see the very birds that were later stolen. But I've tried to just keep in mind, and hopefully for the reader as well, that the person who deserves blame here is the one who committed the crime, and it's tempting to blame the institution. But the British Museum, like so many natural history museums, these are public trusts, and they're not swimming in money. It's free admission to go to this place that exists to try to just propagate human knowledge, and they're totally dependent on federal funding. And in this case, they just, I mean, I was there not too long ago for a book tour in England, and they now have a security camera up by the alleyway and by the window that was broken out, but I noticed it was pointed in the wrong direction, like and so you know, I get frustrated with them, but at the same time, I mean, it's they can only work with what they have, and they're not a crime fighting organization either, you know. In this case, their trust was really betrayed by this kid, and they're still suffering the consequences. Trust.
Right after generations of protecting these specimens and birds through wars and moves and,
right,
you know,
other threats. Like
other
that.
Threats, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's really, it's very devastating once you realize that not even just the lengths that naturalists went to build this collection, but that, I mean, there were something like 140,000 pounds of thermite bomb dropped on London during World War One by German Zeppelins. The Natural History Museum was back in London at the time. This collection was kept there, and it was hit 28 times during the Blitz during World War II. And that prompted the curators to marshal this fleet of unmarked trucks in the middle of the night to basically, you know, slip this collection out to this countryside museum in Tring, and it was, you know, believed that they were finally safe there. And so the fact that these birds survived, you know, World War One and Hitler's bombers and were eventually stolen by a fly tire is, it's kind of hard to process sometimes.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Kirk Wallace Johnson. He's the author of The Feather Thief, Beauty, Obsession, and the Natural History Heist of the Century. So, Kirk, there's so much more we could talk about, and I have to recommend to our listeners that if they want to read more about the history of these incredible specimens that were taken, they pick up the book. But I also want to talk about your goal. So you learned about this, and then you thought, you know, I want to track down these feathers and skins and see what happened to them and see what can be recovered. And so talk to us a little bit about, like, your experience there.
Yeah, well, when I first heard about this, I did not know anything about birds. I didn't know anything about, you know, salmon fly tying. I didn't know anything about Victorian history. This was almost like a kind of secret hobby of mine, just to try to figure out what happened. So I would, you know, go and testify before Congress about what was happening in Iraq, and then go back to my hotel room and log into these private feather trading forums and take screenshots of these illicit transactions. And so it was just, I had sort of a split personality while I was working on this. And then at some point, at the time it was something roughly like a third of my life I had spent trying to confront the humanitarian consequences of a war that I had never supported. And I really was kind of desperate to start moving on with my life and putting the war behind me to the extent that I could. And for whatever strange reason, but this investigation and this book kind of became almost like a personal life raft for me, in that it allowed me to tackle something much different, in some respects much lighter, even though there's some real serious implications to this heist. But I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't know how to carry out an investigation like this. I just felt that something bad had happened here. And by the time that I heard about it, which was something like 6 months after the sentencing, at that point, Edwin never spent a night behind bars. Something like half of the birds were still at large, and from what I could tell, they were still being openly trafficked in this community.
Yeah,
they were making jokes about breaking into other museums, and so I was really just animated by this frustration that something wrong had happened, and no one was looking for these things anymore. So it might as well be me.
Well, yeah, we only have like 3 or 4 more minutes, so let's get to what happens to Riss. Eventually, he's caught. He immediately confesses to the crime. He has birds and feathers, skins as they're called, in his apartment. It was estimated that he took somewhere around 300 whole skins, and they recovered over half of them. He pleads guilty, but he uses, and I know we could spend another half hour on this, but he hires an attorney who is the cousin of Sacha Baron Cohen, just to make things more wacky, who uses an Asperger's defense. You have a minute to summarize the use of that defense,
yeah,
and
actually,
it worked.
And actually, his attorneys got him a meeting with Borat's cousin, who was a preeminent expert on Asperger's, and the Brits have kind of a soft spot when it comes to sentencing people with Asperger's, and I'm not for throwing people on the spectrum into prison or anything, but without giving away all the twists and turns of the book, he admitted something fairly shocking to me, the feather thief did, over this 8-hour interview where he, you know, basically showed me how he faked it during this assessment. This story is, it kind of just mushroomed into, craziness in every dimension. And I'm still, even since the book has come out, I'm still finding out all kinds of new shocking things to it.
Well, so we'll have to look for an addendum then, an updated version in a year or two.
Yeah, or people can, in Salt Lake at least, Salt Lake City can come and see me in a couple weeks when I'm over there, and I can give the update in person. Oh.
So I just wanted to mention that. Yep, so Thursday, April 25th at 7 p.m., right? You'll be at the King's English?
Yes. The 15th Street Gallery, I guess?
Yep, okay.
Yep. With the King's English, yeah.
Yeah.
And do people need to register for this in advance or get a ticket, or they just show up at the door?
You know, I don't know. I'm assuming that's all up on their website, but
okay.
I can't imagine they're charging that much just to see little old me if you do have to buy a ticket. So.
Well, it's a fascinating book. Both Chris and I spent a significant amount of time with it before the show today, and
absolutely.
Yeah. Highly recommend.
I'm honored that you had me on. It's been a lot of fun to talk about it.
Well, I'm going to be there, and I got another 8 questions for you. So I hope I know what
great.
I'll either ask during or I'll take you aside afterwards, because it's an amazing book and so many other things we didn't get to. It's called The Feather Thief: Beauty, Obsession, and the Natural History Heist of the Century. by author is Kirk Wallace Johnson. Kirk, so thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us this morning.
Oh, thank you for having me.